MacCast, Sunday, September 25th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Are you feeling like me? Are you feeling like we are in just one, like, giant waiting pattern, waiting for some giant ball to drop? And by giant ball, I mean the iPhone 5, right? We're just sitting around waiting for Apple to do something. I guess also the iPhone 5 and new iPod Touches and iOS 5 and iCloud. And, like, it's just I'm a giant pent-up ball of anticipation. And this last week did not help waylay my fears. I've been expecting and waiting to hear about when Apple's going to be holding its special event, which should be coming up here. Well, we'll talk about exactly when it might be coming up in this episode. But before we dive into all of that, I want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Smile. They make awesome applications. I am a huge fan of everything that they do. I use all of it. Text Expander is a personal favorite, but I want to talk to you this week about PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro, because they just put out an update. The 5.5 version came out, and it added robust page numbering. So if you're editing and working with multi-page PDFs, you now have full control over the numbering in PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. You can specify the position, the header, the footer, the alignment, where you want it. You have all kinds of different numbering options. You can do Roman numerals. You can do letters, numbers, of course. And if you deal with legal documents, it supports Bates numbering also. And they added in, for Lion users, now full screen support. So you can use that beautiful full screen mode in Lion. And of course, there's all the other great stuff that makes PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro so awesome. You know, I use it a lot for signing documents, for filling out forms. I've gone paperless. I hate it when I have to do anything on paper anymore. If I can do it in PDF Pen, that's where I'm gonna have it. And they have free trials available. And even better, right now for MacCast listeners, you can get 20% off PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro, and that also includes the family and office packs. So if you want to save some money at checkout, use the code MACCAST11 and you'll get 20% off. And you can get all the details and your copy of the software by going to smilesoftware.com/MACCAST. They'll have the details on the promotion there along with the coupon code, so you don't even have to remember it. Just go to smilesoftware.com/MACCAST right now and save 20% off on some great software. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MACCAST. So Apple's new Thunderbolt displays are here, and they are awesome. They are getting some great reviews. One of the better and more technical ones is from the folks over at Anand Tech. If you don't know Anand Tech, they do great, really in-depth technical reviews. So if you want to get into all the minutiae, the nitty-gritty, the technical details, they do a really great job. And they also, along with their review, have a 15-minute video that goes into all the benefits, what makes these displays really great, and a lot of the Thunderbolt technology. I did an episode on Thunderbolt for MacCast members, but they go into some of that on the Anand Tech review. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But there's some things you should know about the new Thunderbolt displays. Apple put out a tech info article kind of explaining some of these details. They do require a Thunderbolt-equipped Mac. So basically any of the 2011 models, the MacBook Air, the MacBook Pro, and the Mac Minis, of course, they will not work with DisplayPort Macs. So you need to have one of the new Thunderbolt Macs for the new Apple Thunderbolt display. The number of displays that you can drive with the Thunderbolt port depends on which Mac you have. So if you want to have multiple displays, it's a little bit different depending on the model. So if you have a MacBook Air, one of the new MacBook Airs, they can only drive one Thunderbolt display. So you have the internal display and your external display. And that's because of the graphics cards. They use the Intel integrated HD graphics, and that's about the limits of that. If you have the 13-inch MacBook Pro, you can drive two external Thunderbolt displays. But if you're doing that, then the internal display on the 13-inch will go black. And a lot of people have been caught off guard by that. Apple says that's built-in functionality. That's how it's supposed to work. So you can't drive the internal and two external Thunderbolt displays at the same time. If you have a 15 or 17-inch MacBook Pro, that will work. You can do two external displays plus the internal. And then the Mac Mini can also drive two Thunderbolt displays plus an HDMI display connected to the HDMI port on those models. But only if that Mac Mini is one of the ones with the AMD graphics card. So that's how it pans out. The other thing to know is that if you have an older Mini DisplayPort Apple display, it will not work when it's connected to the Thunderbolt port connector on the back of the Thunderbolt display. So Thunderbolt can daisy chain Thunderbolt displays, but for some reason, I guess, the Mini DisplayPort displays will not work when connected directly to the Thunderbolt port on the back of the Mini DisplayPort. And that may be for the same reason that you can't connect Apple's LCD Cinema display directly to the Thunderbolt port on a Thunderbolt Mac, and it's because you need a Thunderbolt cable to connect, and Apple has that integrated cable that comes on the monitor that's probably not Thunderbolt supported. So I guess Macworld kind of found a way around this. They found out that if you connected your LCD, Apple LCD display to the Thunderbolt port on another device, in their case they used the Promise RAID, and put that in the chain, and it, I think, needs to be the last device in the chain if you're using a Mini DisplayPort monitor. If you connect it to that, then that apparently did work, but it just will not work daisy-chained back into the back of the Thunderbolt monitor. And I think Apple does note that in the tech support article. So just some things to note about these new Thunderbolt displays. And, you know, the Thunderbolt displays are really nice, especially if you have one of the new MacBook Airs, because the back of the display has a bunch of additional ports, and because it's running over Thunderbolt, you get the full performance of that. Thunderbolt technology basically combines Mini DisplayPort and PCI Express. So on the back of that thing, you have three USB 2.0 ports, a FireWire 800 port, a Thunderbolt port, and gigabit Ethernet, and that's all going to work like as if it were native stuff inside the device. And the Anantech piece noted that the speed of the FireWire and the Ethernet are comparable to as if you had that built right into your MacBook Air, and that's because it uses that PCI Express technology, so it's just like you plugged in a card. That, coupled with the fact that they also mention there's discrete controllers for each interface on a motherboard inside the monitor. So that's a pretty cool bit of technology going on there. You get a lot of bang, but it does come at a little bit of a steep price tag. You know, $999 US for that display. Beautiful 27-inch display, but definitely on the higher end in terms of the price scale. And if you do buy one, Apple did release this week a Thunderbolt display firmware update. The copious release notes that Apple often gives with its products simply say it improves the stability of your Apple Thunderbolt display. And that's good to know because a stable display is important on both counts. Good news for Final Cut Pro 10 users. There's now more Pro in Final Cut Pro 10. And the reason is that the latest version of Final Cut Pro came out this week, an update 10.0.1, I believe it's labeled. And many professionals, if you remember, complained about the lack of some critical features when Apple launched Final Cut Pro 10. They didn't restore all of the features that the pros were looking for, but they did put some critical ones back in there. There's some features that are never going to come back, but Apple did push out this update, and it addresses at least some of the concerns. The big one in this one was the ability to import and export XML-formatted information. And this means that there's now a workaround so that you can bring your older Final Cut Pro 7 projects into the new version of the app. One of the huge complaints was that there was no way or no support for opening older Final Cut Pro 7 files with Final Cut Pro 10. Now you can kind of do it. You have to export to the XML and then import, but at least there's some path for doing that. They also added GPU accelerated export, which should significantly speed up output. And they released a development kit for camera makers so that they can add support for new camera hardware as they put it out and not have to wait for Apple to do a major application update release before their cameras are supported. So that'll be great moving forward, because often the hardware comes out between releases and you'll be able to get your new cameras and start working with those directly in the product without having to wait, assuming that the developer of the camera uses the kit to build new drivers or build new plugins to support those cameras. Apple also did promise that they're going to bring some other critical updates in 2012. They're going to bring back multicam editing support and support for broadcast video monitoring. So those are two, again, features that pros really rely on that were kind of pulled from the product and will hopefully make their way back in. And if you've been hoping to get your hands on and try out Final Cut Pro 10, maybe you're not sure. I think Apple's trying to win over some new users. They're going to give you a little free sample of the app. They now have a free trial available. You can try it out full featured for 30 days, and it's available from Apple's website at apple.com/Final Cut Pro. So if you want to see what all the hubbub's about, you can take a look for yourself. So as I was alluding to at the top of the show, we're all sitting around kind of wondering, when are we going to get new iPhones? When is Apple going to do something with an event? What's going to happen? Well, it looks like October 4th is kind of the date all the rumors are pointing to. D All Things Digital reported that Apple is going to hold the event, but it's being held on Apple's campus at the town hall. Now, historically, the larger events have been held at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. There wasn't really any indication from D All Things Digital as to why Apple made the change. A lot of speculation, thinking that maybe the timeline hasn't kind of gone the way Apple's wanted. They've had some delays in there, so maybe they had to pull out of that center and it's easier to put together a quick event on their campus. It could just be that Apple wants a more intimate setting. No one really knows, but it's sounding like October 4th should be the date. If that is the case, I would expect that we would get invites going out to press by Tuesday, September 27th. Apple typically gives the media about a week to get things in order and get out to San Francisco, or in this case, Cupertino, for the event. What is expected to be announced would be iOS 5, iCloud, new iPhones, new iPod Touches, maybe some stuff with iTunes, and the speculation at this point is that iOS 5 and iCloud would be released early, probably in around the time frame of the 9th to the 12th of October, and then the iPhone 5 would be going on sale around October 14th. The 9th through the 12th and the 14th and 15th dates are reportedly blackout dates for Apple Store employee vacations. So that's kind of why the media and everybody's speculating those will be the release dates for the different products. And Al Gore, who is on the Apple board, a former vice president of the United States, also said that the iPhone 5 would be here in October. So everything, all signs are pointing to an October release. As far as when the actual dates are, everybody's just kind of speculating at this point. And there's still those rumors floating around that, you know, maybe there won't even be an iPhone 5. There's a lot of sites that are still putting bets on an iPhone 4S. And the main difference is, in case you're wondering what's all this iPhone 5, iPhone 4S stuff, the main differences would be that an iPhone 5 would be a more radical design change in terms of the actual hardware, maybe a few higher-end specs in terms of the camera and stuff like that, whereas an iPhone 4S would probably be about the same form factor as the current device with an upgraded processor, upgrade to the A5, maybe a better camera, just minor improvements. And Apple has done that in the past. You know, we saw them take the iPhone 3G and then just go to the 3GS. So they've taken those steps. A lot of it may be based on kind of the components, how testing has gone with a new model. No one really knows at this point, and we're just going to have to wait for the event and wait for Apple to tell us what we're getting. It could turn out that we're getting both devices, that an iPhone 5 is the new high-end device and that there's a lower entry-level model, iPhone 4S, maybe something to replace the current iPhone 3GS that they're pricing out at the $49 kind of dollar price point at this point. So we'll have to see. What do we actually know Well, not a whole lot. I mean, as these things go, we don't get a lot of details, but there are some facts. We do know, and we can assume that we're going to get some sort of device announcement soonish. And I guess I'm fudging a little bit because this isn't even 100%, but if Apple wants new stuff in the pipeline and out for the holidays, we have to assume that this needs to happen. Apple needs to have an event. They need to, October's kind of, they're getting down to crunch time, I guess is what it comes down to. So we should hear something really soon. And again, there's so much speculation and so many leaks out there that's really seeming like it's going to happen. We do know that T-Mobile is not going to be getting the iPhone this year. And this is based on a statement by their chief marketing officer, Cole Broadman. Came out and said, we're not getting the iPhone this year. T-Mobile's going through the whole AT&T merger thing. So it's likely that that if that goes through, then they'll be getting the device. And, well, of course they will because AT&T has it. I mean, that makes complete sense. It's still looking like Sprint will be added as an iPhone carrier. But again, just speculation at this point. And just to put a little perspective on the reality of these leaks, you know, the media gets stuff. It was reported this week that OtterBox already had iPhone 4S cases in the works because some images leaked out of OtterBox packaging showing an iPhone 4S case. One of the stories said reportedly that they'd already had 3 million cases put together and ready to go. And if you're wondering where they get this stuff, well, OtterBox then posted a teaser banner on their website that said iPhone 4S or iPhone 5. Yes, and that was all it read. And the blogosphere, again, went crazy saying, oh, OtterBox is leaking. You know, they're kind of tipping their hat and saying there's going to be an iPhone 4S and an iPhone 5. Well, guess what? They followed up. A couple people asked their marketing people, and this is just all marketing and preparation. They have no NDA with Apple. They have no inside information. They're just planning on what they're going to do based on all the rumors and everything else that we've been hearing. And what they were doing is putting together some comps of iPhone 4 packaging or iPhone 4S packaging and designs and just playing around with things just in case, you know, Apple releases that. They're just trying to be ready on day one so that they can move quickly because that becomes important, this market, you know, speed to market and the speed and the ability to adapt. So I have a feeling a lot of times when we see these leaked cases and stuff like that, these are companies, these are prototypes and things like that they're putting out just in case, and they're doing it all on this speculative information so that they can react quickly and move and get their products into market and into channel and stuff like that. So, you know, you can't believe everything you read or even see in terms of these product images, and I think this just illustrates it. Until Apple tells us what they're going to do, we really are just speculating and guessing. And, you know, it's fun to do, but we have to also keep that all that stuff in perspective. So kind of back to the rumors, you know, if the iPhone 5 does end up being the device, it's already being reported that there might be a shortage or they might be in short supply. We know demand is going to be really high, but sounding like there might be some manufacturing problems, specifically with some of the screens. Boy Genius Report says that DigiTimes is reporting about a possible problem with iPhone 5 screens being supplied by WinTech. It's something called a delayed bubble, which I found kind of humorous because it might be causing delays in iPhones shipping. But apparently what's happening is that a bubble is forming and developing between the panel and the lamination layer after WinTech sends the displays out for assembly. So it's kind of taking a little time for this defect to show up. A WinTech spokesperson wouldn't confirm the story and only said that the company is meeting all of its delivery schedules. So as far as what WinTech is saying, they're saying everything's fine. WinTech supposedly is supplying about 20 to 25% of the iPhone 5 display panels. So if there are shortages at the factory, that could result in constrained supplies at launch. But that's really been nothing new to Apple launches. You know, there's always constrained supply, I think, whether or not there's production issues. But hopefully, you know, we don't end up with seeing some reports of defective screens out and hitting the market. It's probably better if they catch them in production and in quality control before they actually hit the streets. So we'll have to see. But, you know, I think either way, if you want an iPhone 5, you're going to have to be there day one and you're going to have to be getting your orders in early. Some security issues cropping up for the Mac this week. A security firm, F-Secure, noted a new Trojan has shown up related to PDFs. It's called the Trojan Dropper OS X or OS 10 Revar A. Revision A, I think, is what it stands for. But it masks itself as a Chinese language PDF file that when you open it up, it installs a backdoor program into your Mac. And the backdoor program, I guess, is a simple Apache web server that responds to instructions from a remote server. At this point, it seems to be a proof of concept. It's pretty benign. Speculation is that the virus developers kind of testing the waters to see if it doesn't get caught by the security firms, which in this case it obviously did. It doesn't appear to be getting any instructions at this point from the remote server. It does install a launch agent, so you can actually check to see if you've been hit by this or infected. I think the obvious clue would be that a Chinese language PDF keeps popping up on your screen, because I guess that's supposed to hide what's going on in the background. But if you want to look for it, you can launch your activity monitor and look for a process called checkvir, C-H-E-C-K-V-I-R, checkvir. And if it's present, all you have to do is quit the process in the activity monitor, and then you can remove it from your home library launch agents folder. In Lion, you remember, in order to get to the home library folder, you need to go under the Go menu and hold down the Option key to see it, because it's actually hidden. And within there, you'll find two files, checkvir and checkvir plist. Delete those, and that should get rid of it. Also, Apple should be able to update their XProtect malware detection software that's built into OS X. And if they do that, that should give you a warning that this thing's trying to be installed on your system. And I would think also just the security built into Mac OS X would prompt you for your password when it tried to install the Apache server stuff. But I couldn't find any details on any of the sites on whether or not that happened, or if it somehow was able to install that portion in the background. I wouldn't think that could happen on OS X, but yeah, I guess the potential is there. So there's that, and then another security flaw was found in Lion earlier this week. This one, again, it's kind of hard to be taken advantage of, but it's something we should be aware of. This one allows an attacker with access to a logged-in Mac, say via SSH or VNC, remote access, something like that, to change the password on an account without requiring authentication. So the way it would work is, if you're logged into your Mac, someone could come in with an SSH connection or a VNC connection using another account. So you'd have to have two accounts set up on your computer, and they'd have to have access to one of those accounts. But once inside that account, they would be able to change your password without any sort of authentication. So if it can be exploited, it's a pretty big flaw in the security, but just exploiting it's going to be a little bit difficult. And Apple has been working on the next version of Lion, 10.7.2. It's been out in developer testing, but it doesn't appear to have a fix for this. So they either weren't aware of it or it hasn't been rolled in yet. There's still time, though, because 10.7.2 hasn't been released. So hopefully a patch for this will be in there. But you know, it really isn't common for most home users to have even multiple user accounts like that, let alone allowing remote access to multiple user accounts. But if you do use that feature, just be aware that this little security flaw is out there in Lion. So a couple of little security issues this week. And I guess we'll end the news for this week with a little bit of a shocker. Apple is set to lead the holiday in tablet sales. Is that surprising anybody? I didn't think so. Gartner released a report this week on the future of the tablet market. Worldwide tablet sales for 2011 are expected to be up 261% over 2010, selling 63.6 million units compared to the 17.6 million sold last year. Of that, Apple is expected to sell the most, with about 73.4% share of the market. Now, that's actually down about 10% from 2010, which again isn't all that surprising considering there's many more competitors this year than there were last year. Gartner, though, doesn't expect any one hardware vendor other than Apple to have more than about 5% share of the market this year. Although if you compare platforms, iOS versus Android, it does a little bit better. Android devices are on a whole are expected to ship about 11 million units, which should account for about 17.3% share of the 2011 tablet sales. Still, Apple is going to be the dominant player this year and into the near future. According to Gartner, Apple will have a majority of the tablet market through 2014. So it's going to be a long time before Apple's competitors seem to catch up. And if you want another indicator this week of Apple's dominance in the mobile space, Susan Michael, a member of Google's legal team and a former FTC official, testified at a Senate judiciary hearing that iOS devices make up two-thirds of Google's mobile search queries. So Apple is dominating in the mobile space with the iOS. And reasons cited for Apple's success in tablets? Well, superior and unified user experience across its hardware, software, and services. Foresight in creating a market for tablets and locking up key component supplies like memory, screens, giving them a competitive price advantage. No one's seeming to be able to touch Apple's price points. And really, that integrated experience, just being able to pick up the device and use it, is really resonating with consumers, and nobody seems to be able to replicate that experience. I also think that the app marketplace and Apple's majority position are also key to their success. App choice and the variety of apps ensure that the iPad can deliver the custom functionality I think that consumers are looking for, and Apple being the dominant player and having dominant market share ensures that they're getting the best apps and that most developers are going to choose to develop for the iPad first. So when a customer is looking around and looking at applications, how they're actually going to use the device, they have the most choice if they pick and stick with Apple's platform. So the iPad's platform success is causing businesses and developers to kind of push the envelope forward, push applications and capabilities of the device forward. We're seeing creative uses. And that's another thing that's happening that's key to Apple's success, is there Apple created the tablet market, but now you have people who are buying tablets and actually creating new markets that Apple didn't even think of. It's going into spaces. I mean, we've seen applications in construction, in medical applications, in business applications. Apple was going after a consumer market, and we're hearing them gain a lot of business market share with the iPad. It's just kind of an ancillary effect. I don't think it was anything Apple directly was going after, but it certainly has happened and has taken off, and that is helping them sell more devices and gain more market share. So Apple is going to be really doing well with tablets into the foreseeable future. And, you know, I, for one, am hoping we'll see some competitors catch up, but it's just sounding like at this point that it's going to be a while before that really comes to be. And so that's about everything I have for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, Gazelle. You know, now is probably a really good time to know about Gazelle and familiarize yourself with their service. What they do is they give you cash for your old electronics, and then they take that and they repurpose it. They try and put those devices back into service. They call themselves a re-commerce service. And if you're thinking about getting a new iPhone or a new iPod and you want to get some cash right now so that you can make that purchase, it's a perfect service to use. The way they work is they will offer you cash for your old stuff. You go on the site, you do a simple search, you find the product, and then they will ask you a couple of questions about its condition, the types of accessories and stuff that you have, and then they will give you an offer right there on screen. They'll tell you, we'll give you this much cash for it. And if you decide to accept that offer, then they will pay for the shipping and in some cases even give you a box to send it in. They receive it. They recondition it. They securely remove your data, so you don't have to worry about that. They'll completely wipe it clean, and then they repurpose it. And then they send you cash, and you can get that as a check. You can get that through PayPal. You can get that as an Amazon gift card, or you can even have that money donated to charity. And if you have an item that doesn't have value, they can handle the recycling for you. Now, they won't cover the shipping and stuff on that, but you can send it in, and they will make sure that it's recycled responsibly, and they use credited and certified recycling partners for that, so you know that it's not going to end up in some landfill somewhere, you know, where it's not supposed to be. So great service, and you can check it all out by simply going to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So on the last show, I commented on a piece that I had read over on 9to5Mac about, you know, Apple's success and some of the reasons for Apple's success, specifically their product naming, their simplified product naming in terms of how it helps market their devices and makes it simple for a consumer to go in and buy Apple products. You know, you just have simple names like an iMac. I'm going to buy an iMac. You don't have these esoteric and cryptic product numbers that you kind of have to keep track of and all the specs and things like that. Well, Apple's simplified product naming scheme may be good for marketing and buying their products, but several of you emailed me to point out the dilemma that comes up when you actually need service or you want to do something with your device. Both Marty and Brent mentioned this to me, and I thought it was a relevant point. It definitely makes self-service support more tricky. You know, you go and you say, I bought a MacBook Pro in January 2011, but it's actually a mid-2010 model and not the newer early 2011 model. And that can be confusing to a consumer. If you don't realize, you know, Apple's product release cycle, then it can be tricky to kind of figure out, well, which exact model do I have? I just have a MacBook Pro. That's all it says on the front of the thing. There's no, you know, kind of indicator that it's an early 2010 or mid 2011 or, you know, future 2015 model. You really don't know what's going on. Luckily, there's a relatively easy way to check using Apple's support site if you just know your device's serial number. So you can go to Apple's support site at apple.com/support. You can click on the online service assistant, and then under the self-service section, you can go in there and enter your serial number. And the way you find your serial number on most Apple products is, I think the easiest way is to go to the Apple menu, choose About This Mac, and then you can click on the little area that shows the OS version number, and you'll notice that'll cycle. Click on it twice, and it'll cycle up and bring up the serial number. So you can enter that into Apple's website, and then when you hit continue, the model number or the model name, excuse me, will be displayed, including the information on which specific year it was. So if it's a mid-2010, it'll actually display that right there. So you can find that that way. If you've registered your products with Apple, you could also use your Apple ID and go to the Apple support profile to view the information. Problem with this method is good luck finding the link to the Apple support profile page. It's actually supportprofile.apple.com. So if you go to that website, and I could not find this link anywhere on Apple's support site. If it's there, let me know, because I must just be blind. I had a hard time finding it. I had to Google for it, and I just found the URL. So good URL to note, supportprofile.apple.com. If you've registered your products, you can sign in with your Apple ID, and it'll show you those model names, and you can find them that way. There's also third-party apps like Mac Tracker, which is one of my favorites. That gives you all the technical specs and details, and it has this really nice built-in feature that in the sidebar there, it'll say this Mac. It'll identify which Mac that you're running the software on and give you all the information and details on that, including the model names and numbers. But, you know, I think Apple would say probably the way around this is just call Apple support. They'll help you figure out, take your Mac into a Genius Bar. They will know which model you have, and you don't even need to know, you know, it's a mid 2010 or an early 2011 model. They can just tell you and help you out with that. But, you know, I don't know that that's the best solution. And I think that's the point Marty and Brent were trying to make, is that it would be nice if there was some sort of number indicator or some way to identify these different models that was more upfront and more visible. I do know that there is the model identifier. That's the thing like MacBook Pro 8,2. Right, that little 8,2 number that designates that mine is an early 2011 MacBook Pro. That is in the system profiler, but it's not something that's really used outside of Apple or outside of any of the technical areas. And it does come up when you're trying to use Apple's support website. If you've gone through any of their self-service support articles, it really is difficult to know which model you have, because they will identify in those support articles this information is for a mid 2010 model MacBook Pro. And if you can't find that information quickly and easily, you might not know what you're looking at, and it does make self-service support a little bit difficult. It also makes doing self-service hardware upgrades a little bit tricky, too. So if you want to upgrade the memory or the RAM in your Mac, or you want to put in a new hard drive, you might need to know some of the technical specs and details. And figuring that out, just Googling around, if you don't know the specific model that you have, is a bit tricky. But that argument I don't buy too much, because if you're technical enough to be doing your own upgrades, you're probably technical enough to figure out how to go into the system profiler to figure out which model number Mac you have and what specific tech information you need to get so you get the right RAM ordered. So either way, I think it was a valid point. You know, the naming structure is nice on the marketing and purchasing side, but can get you in a little hairy situation when you're trying to do some of this support sort of stuff. You know, I think it's been a little while since we talked about backup and backup strategies here on the MacCast. It used to be a favorite topic of mine, but I guess we must all be doing pretty well with our backup strategies. Most of us probably, but, you know, it's always good to dive back in and discuss it. And I got this voicemail this week from Honor, and I thought it'd be a great time to kind of dive back in and discuss some backup stuff.
Hi, Adam. This is Arne from Germany. I'd like to describe my backup strategy at home, maybe for your feedback or maybe also as an inspiration for others. So here's the deal. I've got a MacBook Pro. I've got Time Capsule, so all the Time Machine stuff is set up, of course. So that's for, I did something wrong situations. Then I have a Mac Mini as a home theater entertainment system. I got myself a FireWire 2 terabyte hard drive attached to it. And what I do then is I use ChronoSync to remotely get things from my MacBook to that 2 terabyte drive. I also use the same software to do the same with Mac Mini stuff. So I have some folders there, which I use for a backup of, well, actual data. It's not using all the OS stuff there. It's just the real data I want to be backupped. And then I've got additionally to just to get the safety to, in case something, my flat burns down or something, I've got an additional dock for SATA drives. So I got the inspiration from you, the way you said, okay, bare drives is really a good way to go forward. So I have this nice docking station where you can just easily plug in a SATA drive attached via USB. And I have a nightly backup there which backs up this FireWire drive to that other drive. So it's, of course, also a 2 terabyte drive there. And then I have the workflow. I have a reminder every month where I bring that 2 terabyte SATA drive to my office, and I swap it out with another one, a similar one. I bring it back home and plug it in. So the next night, of course, there's a lot of differences which will be backed up there again. And yeah, and that's my setup. So I don't use any web stuff, because I feel that's pretty much, I've got all in my control. And and of course, I don't know what the cloud services really do with my data. Probably, is it safe? Is it really? Does not know nobody get to my data there? Probably one side thought of myself is maybe also a question to, well, iCloud as well, is what about these cloud services? I mean, I'm from Europe, so and I know there's this Patriot Act from US, so basically any secret service can really say, give me that data of your clients. So that's a little bit concerning for myself, because I don't feel that this is really should apply to my data there if I use Dropbox or other cloud services based in US. But that's a little bit a different story, of course. Well, I'd love to get some feedback on my setup, and love your show, and bye.
Hey, Honor. You know, I think I want to address your last comment kind of first, and then I'll get to kind of your backup strategy and just some thoughts on that. But I think you're right. I mean, you have to think about the laws that are in different countries governing these cloud services, and you have to just kind of decide. I think you've already decided that you don't want your data subject to the privacy and security laws of the United States. You'd probably prefer to have more European ones. So in your case, you probably, if you want to do cloud backup or use cloud services, you're going to want to look for a service that's based in your area in Germany or Europe or the EU, whatever you're most comfortable with. I know for a fact that the laws in Germany are even different than other parts of Europe, so in terms of privacy and things like that. So you want to find a service that you're going to be comfortable with if you're going to be backing up to the cloud. Now, that said, it sounds like you're not doing cloud backup right now, and maybe for some of those reasons that you mentioned. And I think you're kind of okay because you still have an offsite. You know, one of the big things about my feelings on backup strategies and the last piece that I even implemented in my own strategy was an offsite backup solution. And I've often talked about the kind of thing that you're doing, which is getting your data either at a friend's house or in an office or something on a regular basis and cycling through that. And that's a valid strategy. Just the whole point is that you don't have all of your backups and your backup hard drive sitting right there next to your computer in case of some sort of natural event or catastrophic failure. I mean, we've had a few of those this year around the world with earthquakes and floods and hurricanes. And those are horrible things. And the last thing that you want to be dealing with if something like that were to happen, a fire in your house, is data loss or more having to worry about your data. You should be focusing on other things at that point. And with an offsite strategy, chances are you're not going to have to worry about that. When you have the time and things calm down and you're ready to get back to that and kind of start rebuilding things, that information and data is going to be there and available to you. So some sort of solution. And I think your solution is a very valid one. The only thing I would point out with that strategy is, you know, hard drives, just in terms of volume and convenience, I think are the way to go. And I think that's what you talked about. I mentioned this and I sort of inspired you from a prior show to do to use bare external hard drives. And I still think it's a valid solution, but they are a little more, I think, delicate than some other solutions that you could use. With offsite backup, chances are it's going to some system that's a big RAID, it's redundant. In other ways, it's backed up. With external hard drives, you're kind of at the mercy of that one device, and it's got components in there, platters and stuff like that, that can and do fail. So you want to make sure that you're also checking your data. It's, I think, an often forgotten part of backup strategies. And this goes for if you're doing super duper clones, if you're doing offsite backups, if you're backing up to hard drives in any way, or even media like CDs and DVDs, you want to check that data after it's been written and make sure that you can recover data off of it. So make sure you can go through there and read files and copy files back off of it. You also want to make sure that you're checking those drives, especially if you're using bare drives. You probably want to run disk utility on them every couple times and make sure that the drives are just checking out okay, that there's no issues. It's not a kind of set it and forget it situation. A lot of us get complacent in our backup strategies, and I know I'm guilty of this myself. I had a situation where I lost some data because I had been doing some maintenance on a Mac, and I turned off Time Machine. I had turned it off and I forgot to turn it back on. So there was a month of time where I wasn't running my Time Machine backups. I went and had a situation where I needed to do some data recovery and I hadn't been reviewing my backup strategy. So it's a good idea to go back in, review the strategy, make sure that it's working, make sure that your schedules are running, and make sure that you can pull data off of your backups, that it actually can get back off. Because it does you no good if you have a failure and then you come to find out at that point that your backups are also corrupt or not good. So consider checking that. And then also you might consider, and I would really recommend this, replacing the external drives that you're using for backup every few years. Most drives are rated to kind of have a 3 to 5 year useful lifespan. I don't know how sitting, you know, stored on a desk and not being actively spun up and stuff like that affects drives. I've heard people talk about the fact that it's better if the drives are running and in use versus just kind of laying around, that you want to have them spinning. Now, in the case, in your case, you're swapping them back and forth, so they are getting used, but there's also periods of time when they're sitting idle. I don't know how that affects the drives, but ultimately, you know, I've had a lot of drives that have lasted 10, 15 years, and I'm still continuing to use them. I can still get data off of them. They still seem to be working fine. But it wouldn't hurt to have new drives every couple years. And I would keep the old drives around, too, as an archive. There's no reason to get rid of them. They still have the data on them, and they should still hold the data for a really long time. There's debate on the longevity range of that. But if you have it there and it happens to work in that catastrophic situation where maybe you have a newer backup that for some reason failed, well, you can go back to that older drive that you have still sitting there, and you might have a better chance of getting your data back, right? This is all about increasing your chances that you can recover your data. And the more copies of that data you have around, the better protected that you are. So there's no reason to get rid of them if you don't need to put that old drive back into service or something like that. But, you know, the other thing that is pretty well known about drives is they tend to fail either right away or toward the end of their kind of useful life. So that would be another reason to keep the old drive around for a while before you reformat it. Because if you replace it with a new drive and that new drive has some sort of defect and fails in the first couple months, you can go back to that old drive and get your data back. But again, multiple locations, multiple backups is going to be your best strategy for staying protected. And the only other thing I noticed in your backup strategy is you mentioned that you're doing your rotation, your offsite rotation once a month. You might consider doing that a little bit more frequently. It really depends on your situation and how critical your data is, what you're backing up. And if you're comfortable with the fact that you could lose up to 1 month of files, you know, if you get to the end of that cycle and you haven't swapped those drives, it could be up to a month of data loss that you could be dealing with. And if you're comfortable with that, then that's fine. Your strategy is fine. But if you're not, if you have critical files, then you might consider stepping that up. You know, granted, you're only going to need that backup, that offsite backup, if you have this catastrophic event like a fire, something like that. And the scope of things, if you lose a month of data, it might not be that big a deal to you. So you could be okay. You have other backups for the more sort of, I think you called it kind of oops situations, right? You have the time machine, you have local clone backups, you have the ChronoSync thing. Oh, and I wanted to comment on the ChronoSync. ChronoSync is a great application. What's really nice about it, like you mentioned in your comment, is that you can do over the network backups and you can set up folders and volumes to be replicated across a network. A lot of the backup strategies won't do that. I know that Super Duper does not work over network volumes, at least not without doing some tricky stuff, just kind of not out of the box. You can kind of make it work. But ChronoSync is a great application for doing that and just for keeping folders in sync. It has that nice feature where it can keep a home folder in sync. I often get questions from people. I have two Macs and I want to keep them both in sync in terms of their documents folder. Well, you could set that up with ChronoSync. And I think ChronoSync is like $40 US. Great application, and nice to hear other people using that app. So that's kind of my comments on your strategy. Maybe the community has some comments for you. If you do, send those along, maccast@gmail.com. Or if you have questions about your own backup strategy, or you have something that you think we should be doing that we're not, let us know. Next up, I had a question from Jason about address book syncing. He has a Mac and an iPod, and has been maintaining his contacts separately in both places, but hadn't set up a sync strategy. And he had some questions before he actually pulled the trigger on setting up sync, specifically in iTunes. Wanted to know if turning on the sync address book option from the info section would replace data on the device or the data on the Mac, and wanted to make sure that one didn't overwrite the other. And the answer, Jason, is that it actually is both or either, depending upon how you want to set it up. Actually, when you enable the feature for the first time in iTunes, you check that little checkbox, it should ask you what you want to do. It'll ask you, do you want to merge the data between the device and the Mac? Do you want to replace the data on the device or the service? So if you turn it on for Mobile Me syncing the first time, it'll say, do you want to, you know, replace the data that you have up on Mobile Me? And then the third option is, do you want to replace data on your computer? So you can have it go any way you want. In your case, it's sounding like you're going to want to have it merge the data to get the address book information on your iPod and what's on your Mac in sync with each other. And then if it runs across any conflicts, it should ask you about those as well and ask you to pick which version that you want to use. Whichever method you choose or whatever option you choose, it's probably a good idea to make sure that you back up your address book data on the iPod and on your Mac before you turn on the syncing procedure. That way, if something happens and anything goes wrong, you can recover and get back to square one and start over again. So for the iPod, it's pretty simple. Just connect it to iTunes and let it do its backup thing. That's going to back up the contact information on your iPod. For the address book, it's also fairly simple. You can just launch address book, go into the file menu, and then there is an export option. Choose that, and then you're going to want to export as an address book archive file. Set a name for that file and then choose a location to save it, someplace where you're going to be able to find it later. And it saves it as an address book archive file, a .abbu file. So you'll save that off. And then you should be good. You should be good and backed up. If you need to restore either place, for the iPod, you just connect it to iTunes and you're going to choose the restore option, let it do its thing, and then make sure that you restore from backup, select the latest backup that you had just performed. For address book, if you need to get your address book contacts back, you go under the import menu in address book, or the import option from the file menu in address book, and then just select that address book archive file. And then that'll restore your address book data back in there. You know, so that's how you would set it up with iTunes syncing. I would make a case for iCloud syncing or Mobile Me syncing, especially when iCloud is released. It's going to be free. And if you have an iOS device and a Mac, it is a great way to go. I've been using Mobile Me syncing. It's one of the number one reasons I have a Mobile Me account. Is just for the syncing, and it keeps my iPad, my iPhone, my MacBook Pro all in sync. And what's great is that it pretty much happens almost in real time. You know, with the push feature, I can make a change on my iPhone and it's almost instantaneously made to my Mac and vice versa. So you could do that. And again, if you choose to turn that on the first time, it'll ask you all those options, what you want to do in terms of merging and stuff like that. Many people will probably also be pointing out that there are other syncing services like Google or using Exchange server. Actually, Google Sync itself uses Exchange, so you could use one of those methods. You can mix and match, like you can use Google Sync and have it sync your Google contacts along with your address book. I tried that one time. I didn't have good luck with it. I know a lot of people who use it very, very successfully. I think picking one syncing method and sticking to that exclusively just overall simplifies things. You know, if you want to use Google Sync, then throw yourself into Google and have all your contacts synced that way. If you want to use Mac and Mac's address book, do it that way. It's just less variables that you have to deal with if something goes wrong or if there's conflicts and stuff like that. If you want to dive in and do it all, though, you certainly can. It's just I've never personally had success with it. I'm sure some in the community could probably give us some tips on how to get it all set up and working. And there's some articles if you do some Googling online. But, you know, I would take a look at some sort of cloud syncing because I think that's kind of the way of the future, and with the devices being connected and having access to Wi-Fi and stuff like that, it really kind of keeps you up to date constantly. But at the very least, don't be afraid to turn on address book syncing through iTunes. It works really well, and I've had great success with it. So good luck, and I hope that helps you out. And then let's finish up today with a quick little Lion tip. I actually found this over on Cult of Mac. Well, it's kind of two tips in one. One I've been using a lot. One of the big features that I love in Lion is the integrated dictionary lookup. So you can highlight a word, you can control click or right click on it in, I think, any Cocoa application, almost anywhere in the operating system. And the first choice in the contextual menu that pops up is look up the word that you selected. And then you get the little pop-up definition. It actually has the definition, the thesaurus, and the Wikipedia entry in that little pop-up box. And I find it really convenient. Sometimes I'm unsure about the spelling of a word. It makes it easy to double check that sort of thing if it doesn't get picked up by the auto checker. And it's just a really nice feature that they've integrated throughout OS X Lion. Well, it turns out that if you use a trackpad, it's even easier to activate and enable this feature. You just put the focus of your mouse cursor over the word, and then you double tap on the trackpad with three fingers, and it will pop up that same pop-up window. So you don't have to do the selection or the right click and go through the contextual menu. You can just do it with a quick three-finger tap. And if it doesn't work for you, it might not be turned on in the system preferences. You just go into the point-and-click tab of the trackpad system preferences and just make sure that you've checked on the feature. But if you're online and you're running a Mac with a trackpad, you might want to check that out. I thought it was a really cool little tip. So that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get trials and more information over at phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, they make Notebook, great application for taking notes and just keeping track of information. You can check it out, get more details and trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, make sure that you get your discount on PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro right now, 20% off for MacCast listeners. You can get details on that at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Just use the coupon code MacCast11 when you check out, and you'll get that savings. Great software, great stuff. And Gazelle, get cash for your used electronics, especially those iPhones, iPods. If you're planning that upgrade, you might want to check it out now, gazelle.com, for more information and details. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. If you'd like to support the MacCast even more, you can become a MacCast member for just a couple bucks a month. You get extra episodes of the MacCast. I try and cover a lot of hints and tips and tricks, go a little bit deeper on some of the topics that we talk about. As I mentioned, I did a whole episode on Thunderbolt and how that technology works. You can get more information on that. Check out all the different options for subscriptions and details over at member.maccast.com. And if you're already a MacCast member, thank you for your support of the show. Also, just support the show by sending in your comments, your emails, your questions. I'm always looking for great topics, things to discuss on the MacCast. I look forward to getting your emails, your voicemails, whatever they may be. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum, forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow what I'm up to in between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And I've tried to post some more stuff up on Facebook, some of the articles and things that I find when I'm doing research for the show, if I think they're particularly relevant. That's the kind of stuff I'm sharing over on Facebook. As a matter of fact, that an Antech article, or actually the video review of the cinema display of the Thunderbolt display that Apple put out, I threw up there on the Facebook feed. So check that out, and it's just another way to interact with the MacCast community. And speaking of interacting with the MacCast community, I almost forgot to mention, this coming weekend, Saturday, October 1st, I am going to be at the Mac Computer Expo. That's put on by the North Coast Mac Users Group in Petaluma, California. So if you're anywhere in the Bay Area, if you can get to the Bay Area this coming weekend, it is a really great event, a lot of fun. I'm going to be doing the keynote panel. with a bunch of great folks. They actually get a bunch of great speakers at this event. Chris Breen, Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer, Gene McDonald from Smile, Burt Monroy is going to be there. They're going to have his digital painting, the amazing digital painting of Times Square that he did, I think, there on display. Jason Snell from Macworld, David Sparks, who you've heard on the MacCast before. He is from Mac Sparky, Mac Power Users. The list goes on and on. Derek Story. It's just a whole lot of fun. So if you can get out there, it's free. Free parking, free admission, so there's no excuse for not going. Great Mac event, a great Mac community. They have a expo floor there with vendors and booths, and it's just a whole lot of fun. So if you can make it out, it's this Saturday, October 1st, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and I hope to see you there. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.